I promise there is one, and I'll get to it. But just to briefly summarize, American arms policy towards Taiwan, our arms sales policy, as it is expressed in documents like the Taiwan Relations Act or Ronald Reagan's Six Assurances, are fairly flexible and give American policymakers and decision makers wide choice of what to do, what to sell. But it's been the decisions that are decisions and the time, the era of this process that is indeed interesting. In general, since the 1950s, when we started arming Taiwan, nationalist government on Taiwan, there was a considerable effort to make sure that the systems sold were largely defensive in nature. There was certainly an effort to make sure that Taiwan had modern equipment. For a while, there was a certain preference in keeping Taiwan's military more modern than that of the People's Republic of China in order to bolster deterrence. But there has also been a clear American preference to convince Taiwan from acquiring what Washington would view as destabilizing capabilities, nuclear weapons, very long-range missiles. And in the late 1970s, American policy specifically mentioned that we should avoid selling Taiwan offensive military capabilities. The definition of offensive was never made clear, but when Taiwan would develop a certain missile capability that was deemed offensive, we certainly let Taiwan know about that. And when Taiwan in the mid to later 2000s hinted that it wanted to develop a space launch system, liquid fuel space launch missile, available open sources indicate that the United States disagreed and Taiwan dropped that project. In general, the United States was trying to provide Taiwan with adequate defensive capabilities bolstered by security guarantees so that a limited Taiwan military capability would be more acceptable in Beijing and to help to paper over the contradictions between Washington's our one China policy and China's one China policy. Now this calculation worked for a number of decades, but in the last decade and in this one, it has started to break down at an accelerating pace. China's military buildup, not just on the Taiwan Strait, but against the Asian democracies, and then toward global military projection, makes obsolete the balancing act that was put in place in the late 1970s. Barring adjustment, significant adjustment, to not so much the stated American policy, but how we implement our policy, Taiwan, by the middle of the next decade, will be vulnerable to blockade, attack, extreme coercion, and even invasion. And as we move into the 2030s, Chinese military pressure will be building globally to force the United States to divert attention and resources from Asia that will serve to compound the vulnerability of Taiwan and our other allies. Keeping Taiwan secure will require constant American reassessment, a new strategy led by Washington to help not just Taiwan, but our other allies to transition into fifth and sixth generation military capabilities. We should also be encouraging our Asian friends and allies, especially Taiwan, to participate in what is the emerging space economy. And of course, as per the Taiwan Relations Act, already mentioned, we should be maintaining our capacity, maintaining leadership in sixth generation capabilities, promoting greater global military and strategic cooperation amongst all democracies, maintaining a lead in space warfare, and, in my opinion, seeking a new level of nuclear superiority. Now, by the mid-2020s, as I mentioned, the PLA will have capabilities that will allow it to undertake coercive missions or even contemplate an invasion. China has options to increase its short-range ballistic missiles from about 1,200 plus about 400 land attack cruise missiles to 4,000 or more by simply producing or replacing current single missile launchers with new generation SRBM launchers that can carry 2 or up to 8 short-range ballistic missiles. China will have be on its way to completing a larger amphibious assault capability. It will have put together the new PLA Marine Corps, adopting amphibious units out of the Army. And it will have the lift to take 100,000, maybe more, troops to Taiwan, largely by mobilizing civil roll-on, roll-off ferries, both large and medium size. For a long time, China has had thousands of landing tank ship size, roll-on, roll-off ships plying China's rivers. It used a few hundred of them to build the new bases in the South China Sea. This is a capability that China has had already for a long time. And the PLA will also have a range of new, formerly called anti-Axis capabilities. First generation will have moved into a second generation of anti-Axis capabilities, and by the mid-2020s, there'll be a third generation. China is also very intent on not missing out on achieving a sixth generation of military capabilities. The designer of the J-20, China's first fifth generation fighter, which just entered service last year, was promoted about a year and a half ago to lead the development of China's sixth generation airplane. He's conducted a number of interviews in the Chinese media and has made clear that by the early 2030s, China will have a new fighter that will be much more maneuverable and also benefit from new information technologies like artificial intelligence. Chinese press is also full of stories about advances in radar, stealth coatings. It's curious, the Chinese timetable for their sixth generation fighter is about the same as that of the United States. Regarding the J-20, informal Chinese sources indicate China will build about 500 of them. The previous administration stopped production of the American major fifth generation fighter, the F-22, at less than 190. Yes, we're building thousands of our F-35, but this is a plane that is intended mainly for strike roles versus air superiority roles. In terms of broader sixth generation warfare goals, the PLA, led by their new strategic support force, will be leading the combining of new levels of information weaponization, weaponizing of databases, and combining those capabilities with new energy weapons and space warfare. We read a lot about the future in which we'll all have brain chips that will make us smarter on our university exams, possibly have very direct health benefits. Just make sure your brain chip isn't made by Lenovo, Huawei, or ZTE. Now, moving on to Chinese developments that will impact the United States and our ability to not just assist Taiwan, but any of our allies. China has global strategic ambitions. Anyone looking at the One Belt, One Road initiative, looking at their investment patterns in Africa, Latin America, can only conclude that China is using its burgeoning economic power to achieve political power, but after that, China will be seeking military access and military power. China is also building the means for global military projection. Its ICBM and nuclear force will rival ours probably by the middle of the next decade. China will be building nuclear-powered aircraft carriers by the mid-2020s. And in a novel twist, China's Navy will be the first to have a totally nuclear-powered carrier battle group. That is a nuclear-powered carrier, nuclear-powered cruiser for air and submarine defense, nuclear-powered submarine for undersea defense, and a nuclear-powered underway replenishment ship, which no other country has built before. Air mobile projection is moving along apace. Informal sources indicate anywhere from 200 to 400 of the new Xi'an Y-20, a kind of a C-17-sized transport. China also wants to develop, even copy, the larger 100-ton capacity transport, the Antonov 124, designed by the Ukrainians. And then space projection. China's space program is entirely controlled by the People's Liberation Army. When a Chinese citizen puts their first step on the moon, it won't so much be a great step for China as a fantastic step for the PLA. And given China's penchant for claiming what they occupy, South China Sea and such, we have real worries about how they will behave on the moon and in other important areas like the Lagrangian points. There will also be, at least for the medium term, very concerning cooperation between Russia and China. Late last year, they held their second strategic missile defense exercise. For a number of years, my colleagues have been asking, what about missile offense cooperation? Certain conversations have been had that we know of that point to that real danger, something that may have developed by now. Already, Russia and China conduct a number of conventional military exercises every year. And when one looks at the flights of Chinese and Russian reconnaissance and bomber aircraft, one sees that occasionally they look like they're coordinated. China, of course, also projects and looks to constrain American flexibility by having created nuclear proxies in Pakistan, North Korea, and Iran. All of North Korea's working ICBMs ride to their launch points on trucks either designed or made in China. And even if the North Koreans didn't want to launch nuclear warheads against the United States, what's to stop the Chinese engineers maintaining these vehicles from doing that and letting the North Koreans take the blame? This is a real danger. Both the Obama and the Trump administrations, as to my knowledge, have not formally protested China's supply of these launch vehicles to North Korea. And after a Pakistani test of a multiple warhead missile in January of last year, there's great danger that North Korea could obtain this technology and be able to launch very quick, in the very near future, multiple warhead missiles against the United States, complicating our ability to intercept them, shoot them down. And then back to Chile. From about 2012 to 2015, China had a project. It wanted to begin to rearm Argentina. The Cristina Fernandez government was weak and controversial and was trying to stoke anti-British nationalism against continued British holding of the Falkland Islands. By late 2014, early 2015, it looked like deals would be signed to begin the rearmament, both in terms of amphibious assault, air combat, and naval combat for Argentina, a country that couldn't afford any of these things, but courtesy of Chinese soft loans would have that capability. At this air show that I just returned from, the United States had a very significant presence. For the first time, we sent down F-35 fighters below the equator. F-22, fifth generation fighters, a B-52 bomber. It's a kind of signaling and a preview of if the Chinese are able to become power players in our hemisphere, then we will have to divert forces to protect our interests. We may not be able to send all the aircraft carriers that we may want to send to a conflict in Asia or in Russia. Now, what to do? For Taiwan, focus of our gathering, I suggest that we simply need to commit to constantly reassessing Taiwan's defensive and offensive needs. It's no longer acceptable, in my opinion, that we try to limit all of Taiwan's offensive capabilities, given the enormity of the PLA buildup and the growing pressure on the United States to deploy elsewhere in the coming decade and beyond. Taiwan is going to be more alone, thus will require more of the capabilities to sufficiently deter a much more modern and capable PLA. The F-35 Bravo, the vertical short takeoff version, its sale is sometimes criticized as being too expensive or too sophisticated or too provocative a sale. It is exactly the kind of system that we should be selling to Taiwan. It's not a combat aircraft so much as it is an information, surveillance, and connectivity platform that can make Taiwan's fourth generation fighters far more capable. In addition, Taiwan's request of 4 KC-135 tankers is more than legitimate, given the degree to which Chinese bombers are now beginning to circle Taiwan, and they'll be doing more of this when a new aerial refuelable version of the H-6K bomber enters service, probably this year or early next year. We will want Taiwan's fighters to be able to keep up with all of the Chinese bombers as they circle the island. China's imposition of new airline routes on the Taiwan Strait earlier this year makes it a much more dangerous location. There will be a greater temptation to use one-way surface-to-air missiles that can't be recalled should China try to exploit these new air routes for military advantage. It's far better that Taiwan use their aircraft to find an errant airliner that is off of its route instead of shooting it down with a missile. With the aerial refuelers, Taiwan can have a combat patrol over here while other fighters check out the errant airliner and possibly guide it back on course instead of having to shoot it down quickly with a surface-to-air missile. We should also be moving quickly and smartly to help our allies move into fifth and sixth generation technologies. The F-35 is an ideal platform to begin helping Taiwan and our other allies to move towards sixth generation capabilities. Eventually, the F-35 will be armed with a powerful laser weapon. It is already an exemplar information weapon. Taiwan also has its own energy weapon development program. We should be offering to cooperate with Taiwan in this area. Energy weapons offer enormous defensive advantages, and Taiwan should have them. And then finally, instead of disagreeing or convincing our Taiwan friends in Taiwan not to have a space launch capability, we should be encouraging this. Taiwan has one surveillance satellite. The PLA probably has a couple of dozen anti-satellite missiles and is building more and more all the time. The state of the art is not to rely on large or single surveillance satellites, but to launch hundreds or even thousands of much smaller microsatellites or nanosatellites that can all be networked and provide 24/7 real-time coverage of the Earth. The Chinese are going to be launching constellations into the thousands over the next 10 years. The United States has a number of programs, both civil and military, in this direction. What's wrong with Taiwan being able to launch 20 or 30 microsatellites in the event of real tension? If the PLA knows that a Taiwan satellite will survive and see their preparations, that is a real and credible deterrent capability. And in addition, the United States is going to need active allies and partners in space. Going to the moon or beyond is expensive. Not even Elon Musk's deep pockets are going to be able to afford his ambitions of putting 1 million Earthlings on Mars. It's going to be difficult, hard, expensive, and yes, we should be encouraging Taiwan to enter this sector, and we should be helping that along, in my opinion, by offering to train and put up the first Taiwanese astronaut. The Chinese are already making public offers to Taiwan, and I think it would be preferable, most likely just as much in Taiwan as here, that the first Taiwanese astronaut fly in a democratic program versus a communist one. And I'll stop there, probably having overrun my time limit.
Thank you, Richard. So I think we've had a very sobering and deep panel here. I will abuse my prerogative of the chair and ask the opening question and then open it to the floor. When you do ask your question or make your comment, please identify yourself to the speaker, and also I request that you turn on your microphone so that we can hear you up front and we're also recording this. My question is perhaps a bit of a news chasing question. I don't know if anybody has read the latest tweet and if we're in some sort of trade war or not, but it seems like at the very least the tendency in the direction, at least of the Trump administration, is of increased economic tensions with China. And I wonder how that might complicate or slightly change the take on your answers, especially considering the amount of Taiwanese investment in mainland China. So for instance, you know, if we're looking at a kind of tit-for-tat tariff war, there will be non-Chinese and non-American collateral damage to that. So I just wonder if you guys might have anything thoughts on that.
So again, I would just start by saying trade war is not inevitable. And even all of the items, I think it's 1,300 that were announced the other day for possible tariffs, that's now been open to a 60-day public commentary period. So there is time, and I think that the goal of the Trump administration is to get China's attention. And they set the bar fairly high. I think China has made some offers behind the scene that they have not yet been seen as close to even acceptable by the Trump administration. But I think those conversations go on. And so I can't say I'm either optimistic or pessimistic, but I do think there's at least an even chance that we end up with some negotiated solution. As for Taiwan, I would say that there's always winners and losers. There are probably many industries that are in China who are part of that supply chain that, if these tariffs go into effect, would be adversely affected. But I would be surprised if there are other industries in Taiwan that would benefit. And the same is true in the United States. I mean, we're listening to farmers, potentially, you know, pork farmers who would be adversely affected, wine producers, for example. But then again, there potentially can be winners and as well as losers. But any kind of a real trade war, so far we're quite far from that, would be, I think, negative for the, not just for Taiwan, for the U.S. and China, but for the rest of the world. It's better to tear down barriers to trade, generally speaking, than to put them up.
I tried to emphasize in my few minutes when I was behind the lectern there the problems of these gray zone conflicts, where it's not military versus military, where it's all the various instruments of national power competing in many ways. And frankly, my opinion, we are absolutely not sufficiently engaged, if indeed we're engaged at all. That said, I agree with what Bonnie said about trade wars. I have no issue at all with countering China's theft of intellectual property. Brief time I was in the Department of Defense in the early Obama administration, I signed off on a depressing series of messages acknowledging that we knew certain contractors had been penetrated, hacked, and it's no accident that Chinese aircraft develop at about the speed we develop. Secondly, as far as doing business, this is absolutely outrageous that American companies trying to do business in China have to conform, have to surrender their own intellectual property, and it's okay for and the assumption by many businessmen is, well, it's just the price of doing business in China. I beg to differ. Company A giving away their intellectual property hurts all of us. And we should not put up with that. So if we are going after China's theft of intellectual property, that's good. We need to go after it. And if there's some blowback or damage or something, hopefully we've thought this through so that we know how to counter the blowback. Another example, you all remember when China brought out the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And our response was to tell our allies not to join. Wait a minute. We're the greatest capitalist nation on earth. We ought to be providing a better alternative rather than trying to adopt some kind of mercantilist policy saying, no, you have to stay in our bank, the Asia Development Bank, and you can't join the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. And by the way, we ought to offer a better deal, but we didn't do that. And that was kind of a blow to our authority when almost none of our allies, Japan accepted, foregone joining the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Penn made the joke about the tweets. Government by tweet is one thing. It does, gives you the impression sometimes that we're doing policy by ready, fire, aim. I'm hoping that we've got a little more thought behind this than which that might appear. But countering China's gray zone coercion, economic, military, law,